From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, we'll evaluate the progress made by Milwaukee's Water Council and one of the driving forces behind it. Later, 11 photographers work independently and together to capture the essence of Wisconsin.
You know, we're all making independent work, but we are kind of all, it's a bit like a band in a kind of funny way. And the being together is sort of like being in a recording studio, and you're coming back each day with material and you're showing it to each other.
And a new documentary tries to capture the allure of spearfishing for sturgeon on Lake Winnebago.
This is Ice Road Truckers meets Deadliest Catch. The sportsmen, men and women that go out to partake of this sport are really unique. It's kind of like MacGyver on ice to go get a sturgeon.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The idea that Milwaukee could someday become the hub for the world's freshwater technology innovations has been talked about enough that it seems that it's a long-held belief by community leaders. The truth is, the concerted effort towards that end is well under a decade old. While several names are associated with it, the water hub is most closely linked with Rich Musen, the CEO of Milwaukee-based Badger Meter. Musen and his work are the subject of an in-depth feature in the February issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Reporter Rich Rovito is with us to talk about how much of the water talk has come to fruition and how much remains so much hydrologic hype. Rich, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Mitch.
As you reported the story, it was ostensibly a profile of Rich Musen. But as you read it, it seems like it's as much a profile of his vision of Milwaukee as a freshwater technology hub. Are Rich Musen and the water hub concept synonymous?
I believe so. There have been a lot of people that have been involved in this in the Water Council initiative, but Rich has definitely been the public face of this. I started covering him back in 2000, and as head of a publicly traded company, Badger Meter, he's known in certain circles, obviously, but he really came to the forefront starting in 2007 when he co-founded the Water Council and with Paul Jones from A. O. Smith. Paul's kind of the guy in the background. Rich has definitely become, as most call him, the evangelist for the Water Council.
Well, and as the Water Council has gotten to be a more prominent entity, has Badger Meter as well? Has Rich Musen kind of shaped the image of Badger Meter at the same time he was formulating the Water Council?
I think it's kind of two separate things. There's some of the critics are saying that this is a self-serving interest on his part, and maybe it is a little bit, but his vision is for the Milwaukee area, southeastern Wisconsin, to become the Silicon Valley of water technology and have this be a global water center. And will that benefit Badger Meter? Probably to some extent, but you know, they're a manufacturer of water meters, so I'm not sure how much that will benefit them.
What initially led Rich Musen and to some degree the people around him to drive the creation of this Water Council? What was the potential they saw?
Well, Rich and Paul Jones were meeting one afternoon at A. O. Smith up on the northwest side, and Rich got to talking about how he thought there were dozens upon dozens of water technology companies in the Milwaukee area, and that most of them weren't direct competitors, and he just felt that this was an effort and a possibility to make this a water technology hub with all of these non-competing firms, and started it just sort of germinated from there.
How are people assessing the work that the council has done thus far?
For the most part, it's been incredibly positive. There's been national publications that have come here and done stories. Al Jazeera even came up here to cover the opening of the Global Water Center in Walker's Point in late summer. So for the most part, it's been extremely positive. However, there are a couple of vocal critics that think this is nothing more than smoke and mirrors.
Right. There are not necessarily many national critics, but there are some local critics of this vision. What's the issue that they're taking with the concept of Milwaukee as a nexus for water technology?
Well, Michael Rosen's an economics instructor at Milwaukee Area Technical College. He says this does nothing to address the real economic employment issues in Milwaukee, the severe underemployment and unemployment of African-American males. unemployment of unskilled and semi-skilled workers. A few years back, Badger Meter shifted a bunch of jobs from its plant in Brown Deer to Nogales, Mexico. I was in a room when Rich announced that he no longer felt responsible for providing jobs for high school dropouts, and he said that he was going to focus on higher skilled jobs, and that this was not that this did nothing to motivate anybody to do better with their lives. Michael Rosen sees it differently. The harshest critic probably to this point has been Mark Levine, a professor at UWM, founding member of the Center for Economic Development at UWM. He says he's seeing none of the aspects that you need, such as job creation, patents, incubator companies that go into the Water Technology Center and come out as full-fledged businesses. He says he needs to see some proof that this is actually generating business and economic development and jobs and employment.
With the people involved in the Water Council, obviously Rich Meeusen among them, would they concede that the jobs that are likely to come out of Milwaukee as a technology hub are likely to be more skilled jobs, even those that don't exist yet?
I would think that's a fair assessment. I mean, you've got these firms that are in there now, these startups. You've got some stalwart companies like A. O. Smith and Badger Meter and Rexnord and some others that are in there doing some research. I think it's too, even though this has been sort of 6 years in the making, I think it's still too early to tell in some regards whether this is going to be a success or not.
Yeah, as you say, it is 6 years in the making, and so far the most visible fruit of this labor has been this Global Water Center, right?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. It's a great building, seven-story building in the Walker's Point neighborhood. They took a century-old manufacturing facility and turned into this this very nice looking glass walled facility. It looks cool, and there's some neat stuff going on in there. But it's definitely at the early stages. It officially opened in September. It's sort of been baby steps along the way. A lot of folks will say that 6 years is a long time. Others, like Rich, will say that 6 years was lightning speed here to get something this like this off the ground. But you know, he points to that, and proponents of the Water Council and the Water Initiative here will point to that as a major milestone of the success of this effort so far.
They also point to the 17-acre space that's adjacent to the Water Center. What's the future of that space likely to be?
They're hoping to have a kind of a business park related to water, and this will all tie into what's going on at the Global Water Center, and that down on what used to be East Pittsburgh Avenue, you'll have that's what they envision as being the global water hub.
And it's now it's no longer East Pittsburgh. It's now what, a freshwater way?
Freshwater way, yes. Yes, indeed.
What has Rich Meeusen's response to the critiques that you were discussing? What has his response been?
You know, he's a very unique individual. He's very motivated. I've never seen him move into an effort without a great deal of passion. He had a stroke 3 years ago, and it barely slowed him down at all. He walked out of the hospital a couple days after the stroke, after they told him he wasn't going to may not walk normally again, may have to use a cane, that he would be somewhat debilitated, might have to use a wheelchair, all of that. He immediately went into his usual mode where he was trying to find different ways where he could get back into action with the Water Council, get back into action at Badger Meter, and it took him a very short period of time to do that. I think that had the stroke been debilitating to him, that it may have also been debilitating to the efforts of the Water Council as well. He continues to move forward with a great deal of passion. If you could have seen him the day of the opening of the Global Water Center, his voice was cracking. He was almost like a televangelist up there, just speaking with a great deal of emphasis on his vision.
It sounds kind of like that. He worries that the critics of these plans aren't going to give him a chance.
He does, and he worries about future efforts. He said that, you know, he's had to battle a few critics, particularly Professor Levine, and he's worried that in the future, any effort to make Milwaukee a better place, to make Milwaukee a better place for jobs and employment and all of that, those efforts may be stymied if people just jump out and criticize them from the start. He thinks that he should have been given more credit. The whole council should have been given more credit for what's gone on here.
Are there labor issues wrapped up in this as well?
Well, Rich, again, not afraid to speak his mind on anything. I've had numerous conversations with him over the years. He's a huge proponent of right-to-work legislation. He thinks that southeastern Wisconsin, or Wisconsin in general, is at a competitive disadvantage now that some northern states have enacted right-to-work legislation. His only unionized plant is his local plant here, the Brown Deer plant. He says he's not actively seeking to add production jobs there because he feels that the union contract for that facility makes it more inefficient than the other facilities. Badger Meter bought Racine Federated a couple years ago. He's moved some work there. That's a non-union plant that now operates under the Badger Meter name. He's taken a pretty hardline stance against his unionized workforce and union efforts in Milwaukee.
One of the interesting points you raise in this piece is that other cities are looking to Milwaukee, much the way the Water Council has talked about. But one of the things that they're doing in looking at Milwaukee is thinking about how they might create their own water technology hubs, places like Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Pittsburgh and Toronto are two examples of cities that have moved fairly far forward with efforts. The effort in Pittsburgh, they actually used Milwaukee as a template for what they're doing there. They too feel that they have a concentration of companies that have a connection to the water industry and can do something similar to what's going on in Milwaukee. Toronto, actually, the entire province of Ontario is engaged in a similar effort.
And you're right that Toronto has perhaps a competitive advantage over places like Milwaukee, as it's just easier to get to.
True. The leader of the effort there referred to Milwaukee as quote unquote remote, and said that I guess it all comes back to this: whether or not Milwaukee could be the Silicon Valley of water technology. I think the consensus when you talk to other folks around North America is that they don't see Milwaukee as being the global hub, that there are numerous hubs doing similar things. And I think the message I got was that they should all be working together to promote water technology and not overlapping on the work that they're doing.
Interestingly, as you say, Pittsburgh actually used Milwaukee as a template for its own plan. And one of the great things I would imagine, especially for a reporter who is reporting this story, is they put together a report that really assessed the state of progress on Milwaukee's World Water Hub efforts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. And it was kind of a good and bad assessment of Milwaukee. Said that Milwaukee's early start to this has definitely given us a competitive advantage here. But at the same time, that Milwaukee is not a leading community for patents and innovation and technology around water. So you've got kind of this ongoing debate as to who is and who isn't leading in water technology.
The Water Council has not gotten heavily into policy issues to this point. But as you say, Rich Meeusen is not someone who is afraid to speak his mind. Are things likely to change on that front?
It was a stance that they said that they would not take early on, that the Water Council would not get involved in policy issues. But Rich told me that he thinks that's the next logical step for the council. I mean, they've obviously got their hands full doing some other things, but the council did not take a stand on whether or not Lake Michigan water should go to Waukesha, things along that line. That could change in the future, according to what Rich has told me.
Do you have a sense for what Rich Meeusen thinks about in terms of the timeline for this happening? Is it going as fast as he would like?
I believe it is. In fact, I think it's going faster than he ever expected. In his colorful language, he told me that he thought he would be in a home somewhere pumping morphine from a tube before he would see things like the Global Water Center being built. Again, it depends on who you're talking to, whether 6 years is a short period of time or a long period of time. But he thinks that things are moving faster than he would have initially anticipated because of the resistance and Milwaukee's tendency sometimes to move slower on these types of things.
Rich Rovito, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Writer Rich Rovito's feature on Badger Meter CEO and Milwaukee Water Council co-founder Rich Musin is in the February issue of Milwaukee Magazine. There's a link at wuwm.com/Lake Effect. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening on this Tuesday morning. We are in day four of our winter membership drive, and things are going well so far. We have a new goal this hour. $550 is the level we're trying to reach, and you can take part in this winter membership drive by calling us right now at 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. Become a part of the equation. It's all about taking an active role in keeping this public radio station alive and healthy. Keeping us alive and healthy in the studio right now is our very own Stephanie Lecce. Stephanie, nice to see you.
Hey there, Mitch.
What were those numbers again?
414-227-3210 or go online to wuwm.com. You know, Mitch, this interview with Rich Musin makes me think of how what we do here is really all part of the equation of trying to keep you informed and give you a deeper understanding of the issues that are impacting our community and the people who are making big changes here.
That's right. Whether it's newsmakers, whether it's people who are doing performances, whether it's the authors that are coming through town, we try to just give you a snapshot into the world around you. It's not a complicated equation, but it's an important one from a radio standpoint. And the equation of becoming a member or renewing your membership in Milwaukee Public Radio is not a complicated equation either, but it's one that's especially important to be a part of. Call us now, 414-227-3210, or go online to wuwm.com/give and become a part of that equation. And when you do, we have a special added incentive during this winter membership drive. Everyone who makes a contribution is entered to win dinner for two in Chicago at celebrity chef Homaro Cantu's Michelin-starred Moto. It features 14 courses. I cannot even begin to imagine what 14 courses of dinner would be.
My stomach just grew three sizes thinking about it.
I keep saying this, that 14 courses for me is actually 2 weeks worth of dinners. but they not only come with it not only comes with 14 courses, but they all come with wine pairings, a private Moto indoor farm tour, and a private Moto lab cooking class with Top Chef Season 9 contestant Richard Farina and pastry chef Claire Crenshaw. It's open to everyone who makes a contribution. Contributions are not required to enter this contest, but they are certainly most welcome. And you can make that contribution by calling 414-227-3210 or by going to wuwm.com/give. Coming up next on the program, we'll start talking photography and a unique collaboration by 11 photographers aiming to capture the essence of Wisconsin. That's when Lake Effect returns on listener-supported Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. For the past year and a half, a group of photographers from the photographic cooperative Magnum Photos has fanned out across America. The project, Postcards from America, aims to capture the essence of specific places across the country from multiple points of view. The fifth and latest subject of the project is Wisconsin. Photographers began arriving in August of last year, some are here now, and the last group will get here in April. An exhibition based on the work of those 11 photographers will be on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum this summer. In the meantime, you can see some of the photographs on the project's Tumblr page as they're taken. Donovan Wiley and Jakob Sobel, two of the photographers working in Wisconsin today, joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio, along with Milwaukee Art Museum photography curator Lisa Sutcliffe. She explains how the project came to Milwaukee.
It was a perfect storm. I actually, when I was moving here, sent out an email saying I'll be moving to be the curator of photography at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Martin Parr was on that list, and he wrote me right back saying, I'm going to be in Milwaukee. Let's get together. And I had known about Postcards from America since the inception. I've always followed the project. So when Martin came, I said to him, wouldn't you like to come here next? And they'd been looking for a city in the Midwest, and I want to let the photographers talk a little bit about why, but it just seemed like the perfect opportunity to commission a group of photographers to come here and provide us with 11 different perspectives on what our community looks like.
All right. So let's have Donovan and Jakob talk a little bit about, because you've been involved in this project from the beginning, both of you. Is that true?
No.
No. Okay.
I'm new in the project. I was not in it from the beginning, but I followed the work from the other photographers and very happy to be in it now.
So is this the first?
This is my first trip with this project, yeah.
Okay. And Donovan?
I've done three. Rochester, Florida, and now Milwaukee. You know, postcards is it's an interesting idea, you know, insofar as it's really about the photographer taking control, taking the initiative, if you like, within the contemporary industry, you know, with so many changes happening within photography and the industry. And this is about really the photographers coming together and working together in a way that can be stimulating to each other. You know, we're all making independent work, but we are kind of all, it's a bit like a band in a kind of funny way. And the being together is sort of like being in a recording studio, and you're coming back each day with material, and you're showing it to each other, and you're getting feedback, and it's a fantastic process. It's a fantastic experience to work with colleagues like this.
And it's that collaboration that I find interesting. And I like the band analogy very much, because normally photographers, you're working on your own. And it's your vision that you're trying to capture on film or digital media. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to present that to the world. But this is different. And how is that for you working differently? I mean, is this something you've done before, this kind of collaboration?
I have never tried it before. I always worked on my own for the last 10 years. Also, I always traveled alone, never with assistants and so on. So to me, it's completely new. But as I just arrived the other day, it's also, well, today is kind of going to be the first day where I'm going to edit my material from the, I did some shooting in Milwaukee in the streets yesterday and went to visit this center for old people's home. So today I'm going to edit and hopefully make the first post tonight from this work.
And how has the getting feedback from other photographers been for you?
Well, that's what's going to happen today.
Oh, so it hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet because I arrived just the other day.
Right.
But today I'm going to do the first edit of my shooting yesterday. So.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that we all have independent, I suppose you could say, styles. Well, I don't like to use that word. It's how they interweave with each other that makes it rich. And we all bring something of our own practice, you know, to the project. And in that sense, it's kind of like a visual tapestry, if you know what I mean.
I also find it interesting the idea that you have this very individual idea of, you know, what you'll shoot, what interests you, what kind of images you want to make public. But then you're also creating something together that's bigger than each individual person.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think the challenge, well, certainly for me, because I'm not American, you know, there's a responsibility to do something that's useful, and to the places that you're in. And certainly from growing up in Northern Ireland, we were always nervous about how outsiders represented my home. So I think when I did the first postcard, which was Rochester, the city of Rochester, there was a real challenge to find a way of photographing that kind of was dictated by the city. And not dictated by the city, but sort of controlled or funneled by the city, and where it would come to me. And I found a strategy to do that. And I think, we all each have that challenge where we apply our practice, you know, with the respect to the place.
Are you coming into it, both of you, with an idea of what you want to show, or are you hoping to just stay open and have it tell you? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, I found a strategy which kind of sounds crazy, but it works, where it really began in Rochester, where I saw a picture. I mean, I saw a building that looked interesting, and I wanted to take a photograph of it. And I realized pretty quickly I needed to get some height to shoot it properly. And I managed to get to the roof of a building opposite, and it didn't work as a picture. But what did happen was that I got this extraordinary perspective on the city, you know, from the roof. And that really became a way of looking at the city. Just, I think I did every roof in downtown Rochester, and indeed every car park. And it's a fantastic feeling. It's like you walk into a building or a multi-story car park, and you don't know what you're going to get. and it's fun, you know. And you get to the top and you go, wow, that's extraordinary. And if you do it all over the city, you do create this kind of survey, and patterns emerge. And then when you leave the city, you've sort of created this archive, which is useful, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a way for people who live here to see themselves differently.
Indeed, because as you know, when you live in your own city, you don't really look at it in a you know, concentrated way.
No, and I think that's true for all of us.
Of course, yeah.
You just get used to it, and you just it's
absolutely
common, and so you don't think about it.
That's right.
And you're not from here, so you know you're coming to a place that is foreign and interesting and new in the way foreign places are for all of us. And Jakob, I know you're just starting this, but for you, so far, after one day of shooting, are you seeing, are there patterns and things that interest you here in Milwaukee that surprise you?
Well, first, I think I look for connections. I mean, I look for having this close encounter with other people. That is my approach within photography. Like, I kind of use the, I use these small pocket cameras, and I use it as a kind of a tool to get close to other people, to connect with them and to communicate with them. So that is my kind of mission in Milwaukee as well, to get to know the city through the people in these close encounters. And also I'm very fascinated by actually the cold weather and the darkness. I often traveled places that were cold and dark, and I tend to look for warm things in these cold places and make this this contrast or combination between the cold and the warmth of the people. So that's what I'm hoping to find here as well.
The cold and the dark. It's near and dear to our hearts right about now, for sure. Lisa, how is all of this going to be presented at the museum? Because I know there's another group of photographers that's coming later in the spring.
Correct. There's five more photographers coming in the first 2 weeks of April. So the way we've structured it is that there would be three different groups coming to town. The first group came in August, and they were centered around the idea of the state fair and the festivals that take place outside and in the wonderful warm weather. This group is obviously here in the deep, dark winter. So looking at our architecture and meeting some of the people, going out to some of the smaller towns. The third group, you know, their plans have yet to take shape, but I can't wait to see what they do. There'll be five photographers joining us then. And we've done an artist panel with each group that comes to town so that the community can get a sense of what they've discovered, things that they've noticed, also get a sense of who they are as artists and what perspective they're bringing to the city. So there'll be a panel on April 6th at the museum. And then this summer we're going to do an exhibition where all of the photographs that have been made will be sifted and will come together. So if you want to come into the Milwaukee Art Museum this summer and see what they've seen, I think it'll be really exciting.
And will that exhibition then travel or go online to be an archive as part of this Postcards from America project?
There's actually already an online archive.
Okay.
The photographers post their pictures to the Postcards from America Tumblr, which you can also see on the Milwaukee Art Museum Photography Council Facebook page. And so you can sort of see what they're making as they're going. And, you know, eventually, as all of these trips are completed, you know, there'll be five or six trips. There will be a larger exhibition that will travel the country with all of these pictures.
Now, for the two of you, how is being part of it? And I know, Jakob, you're still so new with this, so this might not be a good question for you. But for Donovan, how has participating in this affected your practice in other ways and, you know, the other kinds of projects that you're undertaking?
Yeah, that is a good question, because I think all of us on Postcards don't go into the, you know, into the project like it's an assignment. You know, we go into the project really being ourselves and bringing our own practice fully to the table, and that has consequences for sure. And I think for me, it has made me think a lot about America and draw parallels to the practice I've been using over the past decade or so, and maybe want to work here in a more long-term way. And I think the ultimate way that it's affected my practice is that it's broadened it. You know, it's really broadened it in a way which I wouldn't have expected. It's so hard when you make work, because you you have to change and you have to grow and you have to evolve, and getting the feedback of colleagues is fantastic, and you end up doing things that you never expected you would do, you know, and you find ideas, you find ways of articulating ideas faster. So it for me, it's I would say quite sincerely, it broadened my practice and hopefully made it richer.
And Jakob, I know, again, you're at the beginning of this process, but do you anticipate a similar kind of thing happening for your practice as you participate in Postcards?
Well, I'm hoping that that will be the result, that I will get inspired somehow to for my work in the future as well. But as you said, I mean, I just arrived the other day, and today I'm going to start the editing, and hopefully we will talk about the work and so on. It would be great for me in the future as a part of Magnum Photos as well to do this kind of project. So hopefully this is the beginning of something bigger as well.
I was going to say the other thing that I would think would be great is the connection, the personal connection and artistic connection that you guys all make to each other that you might not have had without this project.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, we are at a stage in photography where we need to talk more about it. I mean, when I say we are at a stage of photography, I actually mean that photography is at a stage where it needs to be discussed and interrogated, given the nature of the changes with digital technology and with distribution and so many things. And we on Postcards are really, I mean, we don't have a high opinion of the photographer, but we have a very high opinion of photography. We really wrestle with that together. We're not complacent about the medium. We're frightened of it. We stand in awe of it. And we try to make the best work possible.
Well, I think it's going to be fantastic. And I welcome you both to Milwaukee. This is just great that you're here. And I cannot wait to see how you see our city. Mm. And this is going to be great. And also, this is Alessandra, right?
Alessandra Sanguinetti is joining us this afternoon. And she'll be traveling out to the sort of western part of the state to look at some of the smaller towns out there.
Okay. So it's not just Milwaukee.
It's going to be the greater Wisconsin state.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Terrific. Well, thank you, all three of you, for coming in today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Sutcliffe is the curator of photography at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Donovan Wiley of Northern Ireland and Jakob Sobel of Denmark are two of the 11 photographers who are capturing images from Wisconsin as part of the Postcards from America project. They spoke with Bonnie North. There is a link to the project's Tumblr page from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You're listening to Lake Effect on listener-supported WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Listener-supported is a key part of that sentence because we are in day four of our winter membership drive, working towards our hourly goal of $550 with an overall goal of $160,000 during this entire winter membership drive. And the best news is when we reach $160,000, the membership drive ends. We could end it during this very show. It would take a great deal of work. Let's talk about that $550 goal before we get ahead of ourselves to the $160,000, shall we? Stephanie Lecce is here in the studio with us with a good way to become a part of the equation. What should they call?
You should call 414-227-3210, or you can go online to wuwm.com/give. WUWM is where local, national, and global events from the political to the artistic intersect in meaningful ways, creating a more enlightened radio experience. We want to help keep your thinking strong here. But have you become a member of WUWM yet? It's pretty simple.
Well, and maybe you're saying, is it simple or is it complicated? How do I do this? Well, frankly, it couldn't be easier. You just pick up the phone, you call 414-227-3210, tell the nice person on the other end of the phone call that you want to become a member of WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, and she'll take it from there or he'll take it from there.
You can also go online to wuwm.com/give. It really is pretty easy. And if you haven't become a new member yet, you might be thinking, I don't have a whole lot to give. How could what I give help WUWM in this quest? Well, not only should I remind you of that hourly goal of only $550, Come on, people. We can do this.
10 contributors at $55 each.
So simple. Way to go with that math.
Thank you
there,
very
Mitch.
Much.
Really, any amount helps us to continue in our quest to bring you the exciting, interesting, fascinating people, places, events that make the world around us so rich.
Maybe it's $50 for the whole year. Maybe it's $50 a quarter. Maybe it's $50 a month. The amount is not as important as the fact that you are a part of the equation. Call us now, 414-227-3210, or go to wuwm.com/give. We'll take one last break and then get ready for sturgeon season on Lake Winnebago with the producer of a new documentary that introduces us to that colorful world. This is Lake Effect on listener-supported WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. It was a rough few months to be a sports fan in the Fox Valley. The Green Bay Packers season came to an abrupt end in the first round of the playoffs, and so Super Bowl Sunday likely passed pretty quietly in places like Green Bay and Oshkosh and Fond du Lac. But the sports world will be buzzing again soon. This Saturday marks the start of the sturgeon season on Lake Winnebago, and conditions are reportedly just about perfect for the event. Thousands will take to the ice for the 16-day season in which anglers haul in their catch with hand-fashioned spears. Ahead of the fishing season, a new documentary on the sturgeon fishing tradition will have its world premiere in Fond du Lac on Thursday night.
For 16 days each winter, a rare breed of sportsmen known as the Frozen Chosen battle the elements and a mythical beast. Families like the Mookies, Dad, son Chad, and his brother Stuart arm themselves with 7-foot spears.
Wisconsin filmmaker Steve Betcher is the producer of the film The Frozen Chosen, which will also show on public television next week. He's with us in the Lake Effect studio with a preview. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
What makes sturgeon such a legendary fish?
I'll tell you, I think it's the length they live. And on Lake Winnebago, we have the greatest population in the entire globe. So the likelihood of seeing a sturgeon or spearing a sturgeon is low. But this fish could be 100 years old and weigh 200 to 300 pounds. Pretty amazing.
And the story of fishing for them itself is a little more, I dare I say, more interesting than your typical fishing story.
Oh, yeah. This is, you know, ice road truckers meets deadliest catch. And the sportsmen, men and women that go out to partake of this sport are really unique. They're really, it's kind of like MacGyver on ice to go get a sturgeon.
Why is spearfishing the way they catch these? Why aren't they just out there with a rod and reel?
Well, you know, this dates back to Native American period, and the Native Americans taught the early pioneers, if you will, here how to do this. And at some point in the early 1910s, 1920s, this fish was pretty much almost extinct. And the DNR has done an amazing job managing this oak tree, if you will. It takes that long to manage its population. Right around the Great Depression is when they opened up spearing season to allow people to take place of this. And it's been going on for 82 years in our state.
How easy is it to be successful? I mean, I know one of the fishermen you interviewed described it as like duck hunting through a chimney.
Yeah, it's really a challenge. You think about it. You go out maybe a mile offshore and cut a hole in the ice the size of a big screen television, slide a shanty over it, and you wait and you wait. And pitch dark shanty, you sit there for 5 hours and every day and you hope to see something swim by. And the percentage is about 7% that you're going to see something, which is pretty low.
And you're really kind of, I mean, these are far enough down there that from what I gather, you're looking for a shadow, essentially.
Absolutely. There are some deep spots in the lake. The lake's actually a fairly shallow lake, but they're 18, 20 feet depth in that. And you have to kind of wait for the fish to almost to swim out so it doesn't see you. And then with this handmade spear, this primitive way of fishing, if you will, you have to launch it and hopefully get a sturgeon.
People talk about it a lot in this movie in terms of bravery, and some of it is obviously tongue-in-cheek. But what are the brave aspects of being a part of the sport?
I think, you know, just going out on shifting and moving ice. That's thin ice, and there's a dive rescue team in Fond du Lac that goes out and rescues people. And there's stories of people parking their truck next to their shanty and going out after 5 or 6 hours inside of their shanty, looking out, and the truck has shifted down the ice because two plates of ice have moved. So it is, you know, it's always unstable on ice.
Talk about the spears that people use in this sport. These are not fishing rods that you can, you know, go over to Cabela's or Sports Authority and buy off the rack.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing at Costco. And they're handmade. And this is kind of passed down from generation to generation, this kind of sport. It's like there's no school for being a pirate, and there's no real school for being, you know, in the spearing business, if you will. And it's passed down from generation to generation. They make spears. It's hours and hours, labor intensive. You know, it starts from little on for many kids.
Well, and generation to generation is a good segue because you spent some time with a couple of the royal families of sturgeon fishing. The Schumachers and the Mookies are really at the top of the heap?
Yeah, it's kind of like SEAL Team 6 versus the MacGyvers, if you will. The Schumachers are five generations on the ice, and the oldest grandfather is 94 years old. He's been doing it since the first year it's been legal after the Great Depression. So they go out, and it's a clan. It's, you know, it's kids, it's grandkids, it's just they invade the ice. And the other shore is the Mookie family, which is three brothers, and they're sportsmen, and they are very aggressive, and they go out in the cover of darkness. They even put up decoy shanties to throw off people that think, oh, are they fishing there? Oh, no, they moved somewhere else. So it's a really fun sport.
Well, and these aren't official contests, are they? This is really about bragging rights.
Totally. And, you know, the quote is, you go from zero to hero in a matter of seconds. And you go into the weighing stations, and it's like a rock star returning, you know, or a sailor returning from sea. And you go into these stations, and there's cheering and applauding and weighing the fish in. And then it's all the fish stories that go with it.
Well, and there's some strategy. I think it's Chad Mookie that you were spending time with, who was really waiting for just the right fish at the potential expense of never seeing another fish.
Yeah, it's that trophy fish they're all hoping for. I think 2 years ago, the largest one was speared 212 pounds by a man in Appleton. And you think about that, it's like pulling up a linebacker you know, out of the hole in a sense. And it's like once you get that fish on, it is Fight Club. They have a lot of passion. And that's what, as filmmakers, drew us to this story, that it's always about people in our world, and great passion makes great stories.
This is not an attractive fish.
No, it's a toothless fish, you know. So when Lady Luck smiles, she has no teeth. So it is very it's a very ugly fish, if you will.
How willing were the families like the Schumachers and the Mookies to share the secrets of their success?
Oh, great question. I think, you know, they are very protective of their tradition. They're very protective of their families. And to get them to say, hey, can we come along and film you guys for two seasons of fishing was a leap of faith for them. But I think they wanted to just share, if anything, their love for this sport. And as sportsmen as they are, this is the largest, biggest event for them all year long. And I think the film reflects that.
And so two seasons, you actually spent
yes.
time the past couple of years?
Yeah, the last couple of years we spent. I think the challenge for us was sitting and watching somebody fishing is not that exciting. So we have to bring to the audience the fish coming out and the fish on the ice and that kind of feeling. So that is the challenge. So we wait with patience along with everybody else to kind of film that.
We have just had the Super Bowl, obviously. The Winter Olympics are getting underway this week. How does sturgeon season on Lake Winnebago compare to those kinds of events?
I think for the sportsmen, this is a huge event. This is a great moment in our state, and it always happens in February. It's a 16-day season, unless it's capped and it ends early. But I think what's also great about this story is it's a success story with the DNR and their efforts to preserve this fish. And it's you can't have one without the other. So the sportsmen and the DNR work hand in hand in the sport, and we've had this unbelievable population brought back to Lake Winnebago, and we're the only spot in the globe you can do this.
What's the atmosphere like when people are bringing these fish off the ice to a weigh-in?
Oh, I got to encourage people to go to Fond du Lac on Saturday around 12, 1 o'clock. There's a couple weighing stations that they register these fish, and one of them is Wentz, and it's a small tavern on Lake Winnebago, and it is like a carnival atmosphere. Photographs, it is a party. And then later on, there's a sturgeon stampede that happens in Fond du Lac this weekend. Fireworks and bonfires and, I mean, music. And it's just, it's really, really a great event. So get in the car and drive there. It's a great event.
How challenging was this from a filmmaking standpoint? I mean, you talk about trying to heighten the excitement, because if you just sat there watching people watch for a fish for 6 hours, it probably wouldn't be that interesting. But there's some really kind of innovative camera work you undertook in this.
Yeah, I think, you know, the challenge for us is we have to survive right along on the ice with these fishermen. So we're struggling with the same issues of shifting ice and cracks in the ice and ice moving every single day. One dive rescue man said it's like a polar bear that rises up quickly on this lake, and you have to be very careful. And then the challenge of getting underwater photography in ice-cold weather is just really amazing. So we wanted to kind of bring perspectives to this that the average person would never see. You know, what's it like for these fish underwater? And also we followed the spring spawning season up the rivers. So, we really kind of fell in love with the sport as we were doing this and the people. Yeah, it's a really, really amazing story that, quite honestly, it's not told very often in our state. And that's what I think is kind of unique.
Well, and to the degree that the Schumachers and the Mookies were maybe reluctant to share all of their secrets, I'm curious about your secrets. How do you do underwater photography when, you know, you might have, you know, a couple of feet ice on top of that open water?
Yeah, that's very true. And we've actually lost multiple cameras on the bottom of the lake. We had to go fish them out with DNR's approval. But yeah, it is a challenge. And I think just kind of keeping your cameras warm and, you know, that kind of stuff and being ready at that exact moment when that fish enters the hole. So you stand with your finger, if you will, on the trigger of the camera, just kind of getting ready to film that, be part of that, and not get in the way. You're in a small little space, 3 feet by 4 feet, 5 feet, and not get in the way of this man that's been waiting, or this woman that's been waiting for a sturgeon for 20 years to swim through their hole for the first time. So, yeah, it was fun.
Well, and it's interesting because you sat in with some fishermen who, within a couple of minutes of their day starting, they had a fish. And then there are some people who have never caught a fish in the 20 years they've been out there.
Yeah, what's interesting, the Schumacher family, the grandfather, who's 94 years old, Al Schumacher, speared the biggest fish for the clan probably about 10 years ago. I think it was a 110-pound fish. We were with his grandson the day, and he'd been waiting 17 years, the day he got hit the largest fish the clan has ever seen in 82 years, and I believe it was 130 or 140-pound. It was just dumb luck, quite honestly, just being in the right shanty at the right day at the right moment when this torpedo comes swimming underneath the hole.
I imagine as filmmakers, you were sitting there sometimes for hours at a time and nothing happened.
Absolutely. And that's where the fishermen start inventing stories. And these fishermen and women have great, great stories to share of things that may have happened once or maybe never really happened. So fish stories go along with this tale just as well.
Let me ask you maybe a sidebar question here. How is it possible that there is a sturgeon spearing and polka radio show?
Oh, this is great. And you would love this. It's a radio guy. There's a radio station on the southern tip of the lake and KFIZ. And on Saturday morning, Jerry Schneider plays three polkas. And then he gives the spearing report. And, you know, on the south side of the lake, we got a 180-pounder that just came in, and then it's back to polkas. And it's so much part of the fabric of our state, which we embrace and we love, and the film embraces it. So I think, actually, it's just kind of a great celebration.
And his wife is answering the phone and taking in the fish reports, and they've got prizes they're handing out.
Yeah, and they hand out, like, you know, we'll pump out your sump pump gift certificates for $20, you know. And so that was also part of the storytelling technique, if you will, to kind of hear the voices of people. And this radio station is just so unique. And I thought, you know, who still plays polkas in the U.S. except this one station? And that's what's so exciting.
After spending all this time with the all-stars of this pastime, if you will, did you find yourself kind of getting your head around really what this was all about in all the time that you spent with these people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think after a while, the excitement they have starts rubbing off on you. And I'm watching in the hole with just as much intensity as they have. And the excitement that they bring, you start bringing to the film. And actually, at some point, you know, when you're editing these programs, you spend so much time with it. And we spent, I think, about a year editing and bringing this program to life. It's kind of like a child of yours. You come really attached to it. So we're really proud of it. I think we want to serve also the people in the film well. You know, I live in this state. We're filmmakers in the state. I want to be able to go outside of my house without getting speared, you know. So we have to be really careful with that, too.
Well, I thought what one of the fishermen said was really interesting, that the excitement to him was as much about what he wasn't seeing as what he was seeing.
Absolutely. One of them talks about, like, when you walk on the ice, it's kind of like Jaws. You kind of almost hear the sound when you kind of walk underneath on the ice and you hear that sound. And I think just that whole anticipation is just so great for these people.
Did you ever take a turn watching through the ice holding a spear?
I did not. Technically, I did not have a permit, so I was not allowed to touch the spear, which I never did. And we had our hands full, honestly, just kind of capturing this and, you know, staying on top of the ice, not below.
In all the time that you were working on this film, now that there is a finished product out there, is there a moment that will stay with you the longest as a filmmaker who experienced this phenomena?
You know, I think it always comes down to the people, and it's just seeing the passion that people have for an activity like that, and that's really what we look for. You know, at one point in the film, you'll see one man get choked up as he talks about introducing the sport to his children and the next generation and just the excitement and pride they have. And you kind of go like, okay, it's just a fish, but it's so much more to these people in this area and that partake of the sport. So that's really the thrill for us, and that's what I'll take back.
There is something significant about the fact that they are looking through a hole the size of a widescreen TV, but they are not looking at a TV.
And it's often the murky water, and you start seeing shadows and shades, and you see current going past. And after a while, you just start, you know, you start seeing ghosts in the water, if you will. But yeah, and I think just that whole experience of waiting and the anticipation, the excitement, and then you just sit and have to wait and wait and wait, and there's no clock for it, which is amazing.
Well, Steve Betcher, thanks so much for bringing us this story.
Thank you so much.
Steve Betcher is the producer of the documentary The Frozen Chosen, which has its world premiere in Fond du Lac on Thursday night. You can learn how to win tickets to that event at wuwm.com/contests. The film will also show next Monday evening on Milwaukee Public Television. Well, speaking of WUWM.com, that is also a great place to become a part of the membership equation. But you'll go to WUWM.com/give or call us at 414-227-3210 and become a member or renew your membership in Milwaukee Public Radio. Stephanie Lecce is with us. We are working towards a goal this hour, are we not?
$550 is our goal for this hour. One little step toward getting us toward that big goal, that pie in the sky, $160,000 for this winter membership drive. This documentary on spearfishing, boy, every time I listen to WUWM, I just think I've heard it all, and then something like this documentary comes along. So I want to ask you listening out there to try to figure out this equation. How much you listen to WUWM, what that value is to you. And then I want you to think about that equation and how you can be part of the equation by supporting the fascinating subjects, conversations, and people we bring here on WUWM. It's so easy to be part of that equation. Give a generous gift. $1 a day or any other donation of any size will help us bring you that great radio that you love.
414-227-3210 or go online to wuwm.com/give. There's another way that the membership drive has another thing that it has in common with the sturgeon fishing on Lake Winnebago. It is capped. So when there's a certain level of sturgeon that have been caught, the fishing season ends. When we reach $160,000, this membership drive ends. Call us now, 414-227-3210. That's Tuesday's show. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll get ready for the Winter Olympics with a Milwaukee professor whose expertise includes both sports history and Russia. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.